Thank you so much. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. And Michael, thank you so much for that very generous introduction. It's a huge privilege for me to be joining you here at your River Inner Forum. As Michael said, I grew up in Wagga, and so it's fantastic to be here, and it's fantastic to be in this setting as well. I remember as a child having many fun afternoons in this park at the zoo over here and the playground, and so it's great for me to be able to come back in a different capacity. So thank you for the invitation. I had the very good fortune of attending Sacred Heart Primary School over in Coringle, just on the other side of Willens Hill. And then, as Michael said, I was at St Michael's and then at Trinity Senior High School, which is just over here on the other side of the park. It was at Trinity, though, that I first fell in love with economics. And that was due to a fantastic and inspiring teacher by the name of Mrs. King. In her classroom, she explained to us how economics could be used to solve many of the world's problems. And she taught us how the right combination of the invisible hand of the market and government regulation could maximise the welfare of the society that we all live in. It was a powerful idea to a young man, and that idea has struck with me through the years that we need to get the right combination of the market and government. In Wagga, I also learnt the value of hard work and the challenges of running a small business. During my high school years, my father had a petrol station and an auto accessories business at the bottom end of Fitzmaurice Street, opposite where the KFC is, down near where the Hampden Bridge was. It was an old-style, full-service petrol station, and I spent many cold winter mornings and hot afternoon summer days pumping petrol, checking the water and oil, pumping tyres and cleaning people's windscreens. I think the valuable life lessons I learned through those years complemented those I learned about economics in Mrs. King's classroom. But I'm here today as the Governor of the Reserve Bank. So I'd like to first of all talk to you a little about what the Reserve Bank does, and then I'd like to turn to some current economic issues that we're grappling with, and I'll finish up with some remarks about monetary policy. You might think you know what the Reserve Bank does. We set interest rates and conduct monetary policy. That'd be correct, but our functions are much broader than that. As Australia's central bank, we print and we issue Australia's banknotes. Our colourful polymer banknotes are some of the best in the world, and they include many cutting-edge security devices to protect against counterfeiting. These notes are printed at our very large print works in outer Melbourne, where we also operate a mega vault. And when you go into that mega vault, you really find out what the smell of money is. It's chemicals and printing, but it's you really get the sense of the smell of money when you enter that vault. Today, there are over $100 billion of banknotes on issue. That's almost $4,000 for every single person in the country. $4,000 of banknotes on issue. They're used less and less for transactions in the day-to-day economy as everything's moving digital, but there's still a really strong demand for our banknotes as a store of value. And hopefully you can see this in my first graph here, which shows the number of banknotes of each denomination on issue for every person in the country. You can see that there are nearly 40 $50 bills out there for every person, and amazingly, 18 $100 bills on issue for every person. I know I don't have my share. I don't know whether many people have $1,800 bills in their wallet or their purse. I think most of these banknotes are under people's beds and stored in cupboards, or some people might have saves. But there's $100 billion out there on issue at the moment. The RBA also has a broad responsibility for the stability of Australia's financial system. Through our operations, we ensure that liquidity in financial markets is adequate, and the Reserve Bank has the capability to act as the lender of last resort in an emergency or a stress in a financial institution. We don't directly regulate the banks, but we work closely with the prudential regulator, APRA, on issues that affect the stability of their overall financial system. The RBA is also the government's banker. when you receive a Medicare refund, it's from the government's account at the Reserve Bank. And when you have to pay your tax, Michael, it's to an account that the government operates at the Reserve Bank. The RBA also processed all the JobKeeper and COVID disaster payments. Those disaster payments during COVID were made through our infrastructure that allows payments to be made 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So you no longer need to wait days for your money. The Reserve Bank can process in a matter of seconds using our really modern and fantastic infrastructure. The RBA also operates the core of Australia's payment system. All banks have accounts at the RBA and they use those accounts to move money from one bank to another. Without this system, the economy simply wouldn't work. In addition, we regulate important parts of the payment system, including credit cards, debit cards, and the ATMs. And at present, we're exploring the possibility of a new form of digital money, which would be some form of digital token that sat in your digital wallet, and that would accompany those banknotes that are in your physical wallet. So we're still exploring the technical and the policy implications of that, but that's an exciting possibility of the future. We also regulate core elements of Australia's financial infrastructure, which is central to the trading of financial instruments on the ASX. And we also manage Australia's foreign exchange reserves. So we have a lot to do. We do all that with 1,400 people. We have offices in most of the capital cities in Australia, as well as New York, London and Beijing. And we have a very large and wide-ranging business and community liaison program. We also have a very large balance sheet. Hopefully you can see this in this next chart. That balance sheet has grown hugely during the pandemic as we've sought to support the national economy. Our balance sheet at the moment is north of $600 billion. That's a lot of money. We're owned by the public, and the Reserve Bank Board is appointed by the Australian government. We have both operational and policy independence from government. And as governor, I have a 7-year term, and we do our job without any political interference. So that's the Reserve Bank. As an organisation, we seek to be transparent, accountable, analytical, trustworthy, independent, and always acting in the national interest. It's a huge privilege to have the role that I have. The RBA is doing incredibly important work on behalf of us all. And I can tell you we take our job very seriously and we leave no stone unturned in doing that job. I would now like to turn to the Australian economy and discuss three issues that we've been grappling through recently. They are the economic recovery, the housing market, and recent trends in inflation. As Michael said, back in March last year, we were standing on the edge of an abyss. There were credible predictions that tens of thousands of Australians could lose their lives, that the health system wouldn't cope, that we'd see mass unemployment, that the economy would suffer deep scars which would take years to heal. Since then, there have been plenty of difficult days, haven't there? But we have avoided these dire predictions. This is due to the unprecedented health measures that were taken by governments across the country, fantastic scientific breakthroughs by scientists around the world, by the very large monetary and fiscal stimulus that Michael spoke about, and importantly, the underlying resilience and adaptability of Australian households and businesses. It's important to remember we have achieved a lot in what's been a very difficult time. Now, as 2021 draws to a close, the economy is clearly in recovery mode. You can see in this next chart, the recovery is taking place after a setback in the September quarter, when GDP declined by 1.9%, which is a very large decline in terms of our history. In the quarter, there were very sharp declines in household consumption and hours worked. On a more positive note, though, the decline in spending was less than we thought it was going to be. It speaks to the resilience of households and businesses and their ability to adapt to living with the virus. It wouldn't come as a surprise to most of you in this room that the farm sector has been one of the bright spots. Farm output has increased by 40% over the past year, and rural exports are up 50%. Incomes have also been boosted by multi-year highs in many the prices of many agricultural products. So it's a really positive story for the farm sector. High values of production and higher prices. It's a good combination. And this is benefiting places like Wagga, and I hope the accountants in the room can see that in the income statements of the businesses they're supporting. More broadly, with the lockdowns now having been lifted, spending's bouncing back quite quickly across the economy. The Omicron outbreak does, though, represent a new downside risk, and really is difficult to know how things are going to play out here. But we do expect the positive momentum in the economy to be maintained through the summer, underpinned by the opening up of the economy, the high rates of vaccination, the very significant fiscal and monetary policy support, and the strengthening of household and business balance sheets that have taken place over the past year. Typically, in an economic downturn, households have to dip into their savings. As you can see from this next chart, this downturn's been quite different. Instead of dipping into our savings, households have added to them in a very material way. In the September quarter, the household saving rate spiked to nearly 20%, which is a very high number. Government supported people's incomes rightly at a time when we had trouble spending because of the lockdown. So we had our income supported, we couldn't spend, and the saving rate goes up. The Reserve Bank estimates that the additional savings by households over the past year and a half amount to more than $200 billion. That's a huge amount of money. And many businesses have also strengthened their balance sheets. They've got stronger cash reserves than they had previously. And provided people have the ability and the confidence to spend, I think these additional savings, the strengthening of the balance sheets that we've seen, will support consumption and jobs and economic growth over the months ahead. The recovery is also evident in the sharp rise in the number of job ads and job vacancies, which you can see in this next chart. As you would know, there are increasing reports of firms finding it difficult to find workers. This is especially so in a range of professional services, in the construction industry, in parts of the agricultural industry, and also in parts of hospitality. Here in the Riverina, the number of job ads is also at a very, very high level. And the surge in ads here has been larger than it's been in the capital cities and in most other regional communities. The unemployment rate has also come down very significantly in regional Australia, and it's now below the unemployment rate in the capital cities by a fairly wide margin. So that's quite unusual in terms of our history to have unemployment in regional Australia less than it is in our capital cities. And here in the Riverina, the unemployment rate is very substantially below the national average, and it's also very low in terms of absolute terms and in terms of history. So the labour market in regional Australia is very strong at the moment. In broad terms, regional Australia is benefiting from two quite significant shifts. The first is a revaluation of where people want to live and how they want to live in light of the pandemic. And the second is advances in technology and changes in work practices that have reduced the need for us all to be physically located in a workplace in a capital city. So it's good news for regional Australia. These shifts are creating new opportunities for expansion, new opportunities for growth. They are also causing some growing pains that need to be managed, and I'll touch on a couple of those in a moment. Nationally, though, the labour market's expected to tighten further over the next couple of years. As you can see in this chart, the RBA's central scenario is for the unemployment rate to reach 4.25% by the end of next year and 4% by the end of 23. If we could achieve this, these would be very, very good outcomes. Australia has not experienced a sustained period of unemployment at levels at this level since the early 1970s, when I was in primary school across the hill here. So if we could achieve that, it would be a tremendous achievement. I think, though, as the unemployment rate comes down and workers are going to be harder to find, I think greater attention is going to need to be paid to training and to skills development than we've done as a country over the past few decades. I think this is a collective responsibility of both business and government to make sure that workers have the skills that they need and the training to deal with the opportunity that's currently out there. I'd now like to... Housing prices have been rising very briskly across most of the country. I think in some of the larger capital cities there are some signs that some of the heat's coming out of the market now. But rising housing prices have really been a global phenomenon. It's been from New York to Seoul to here in Wagga. It's truly been a global phenomenon. It's partly the result of lower interest rates, but it's also the result of shifts in preferences of how and where people want to live. The available data suggests that housing prices here in Wagga have increased by around 20% over the past year, which is similar to the increases that have been recorded in the large capital cities. Another recent feature of many regional housing markets is a decline in the availability of rental accommodation. And I understand this is a problem here in the Riverina, with the published vacancy rate now at a very, very low level. I think this is one of the growing pains that I spoke about before. The housing markets in many regional communities have struggled to keep pace with the surge in demand for housing, and there's pressure on rental accommodation and rents in many of our towns. On the more positive side of the ledger, though, the supply side is now responding. Over recent months, residential building approvals here in Wagga have been at a very high level, as they've been nationally, and this extra building is supporting the regional communities and it's supporting the country as a whole. In time, this extra building will increase the stock of housing and it will take some of the pressures off housing markets we're experiencing, but it is going to take time. There's been a big shift in demand and the supply side takes time to respond to that. One of the challenges I understand here is finding the workers to build the extra houses that are needed. It will be resolved in time, but it will take time. In terms of the RBA's responsibilities, we do not target housing prices, nor would it make sense for us to do so. It's certainly the case if we'd had higher interest rates over the past couple of years, housing prices would be lower. But higher interest rates would have also meant fewer people had jobs, and wages growth would have even been lower than it's been. That doesn't seem an attractive trade-off to me, and it's certainly not one within our mandate to make. The solution to concerns about the high level of housing prices isn't higher interest rates. It's reforms that address the underlying balance of supply and demand in our housing market, and there are plenty of reforms that could address that. The RBA's focus instead has been on the sustainability of trends in household borrowing. It's important that during a time of record low interest rates, that people don't borrow too much. At some point in the future, interest rates will increase. Hopefully our policies will work and we can raise interest rates at some point. The RBA has been working with APRA, the bank regulator, to make sure that banks have appropriate buffers and that they take into account the possibility of higher interest rates when they're deciding how much to lend to people. I think it's really important that both the banks and the household borrowers pay attention to these buffers and maintain them, because at some point interest rates will go up. That brings me to the third topic that I wanted to cover, and that was inflation. After many years in which inflation was very low around the world and people really didn't worry about it, it's recently increased very sharply in the United States and in Europe. And as you can see in the left-hand side of this chart, in the United States, CPI inflation is currently at 6.8%. That's the highest in almost four decades, and in some of the European countries, inflation is also the highest that it's been in four decades. This reflects a combination of higher energy prices, a decline in the number of people in the workforce, which has boosted wages, and a supply side that's had trouble keeping pace with a huge surge in demand for goods during the pandemic. I think these factors are expected to wane over the next year or so. So inflation rates in the North Atlantic economies are expected to come down, although it is still uncertain about by how much they're going to come down and when that's going to be. The main point I wanted to make here, though, is the situation in Australia is quite different. You can see that on the right-hand side of this graph. In underlying terms, inflation in Australia is at 2.1%. And it's only just returned to the 2-3% range for the first time in 6 years. In headline terms, inflation's running at 3%, not 6.8. It's running around 3%, and it's It's higher than underlying inflation due to higher prices for petrol and the cost of building a new home. So inflation in Australia is higher than it has been, but it's not as high as it is elsewhere in the world, and in the historical context, it's not that high. I think two factors help explain the difference between Australia and the United States in terms of inflation. The first is different dynamics in the electricity and gas market. Here, the price of electricity is falling. It had risen a lot over previous years, but right now it's falling, and we expect it to continue to fall. In contrast, electricity and gas prices in the US and in Europe are rising very, very quickly. So that's quite a different dynamic. The other substantially different dynamic is what's going on in the labour market. Wages growth in Australia is still quite low. In the US, wages are growing around 5% at the moment. Here they're growing just above 2%. You can see this in this next chart. The rate of wage growth has picked up recently, but it's only returned to the rates that were prevailing before the pandemic. And I used to think they were too low. Michael, I probably went to the cabinet and I said I thought this was too low. So I thought kind of 2% wage growth is too low because we wanted to deliver you an average rate of inflation of 2.5%. And as long as there's reasonable labour productivity growth in the country, which I expect there will be, that wage growth of 2% isn't consistent with 2.5% inflation. So wage growth has picked up, but it's still pretty low. There are certainly hot spots in the labour market at the moment, and there are some areas where wages are increasing very briskly. But most Australians are experiencing wage growth starting with a 2. And some people, their wages are still growing up, starting with a 1. And there are some people who haven't had a pay rise for a while. So there are hot spots at the moment, but the vast bulk of us are getting wage increases around the 2% mark. We're expecting that as the labour market improves and the unemployment rate comes down, that wage growth will pick up. But I think it's going to pick up pretty slowly. We're not going to see the same type of thing that's happened in the United States and the United Kingdom. There are some structural features of our wage setting process that impart quite a lot of inertia into the system. The first of those is the enterprise bargaining system, where wages only get renegotiated once every 2 to 3 years. Another feature is we have a national wage case, which is just once a year, which affects award wages. And the third element that's quite important is the governments have public sector wage policies, which they change only slowly. So you put all those things together, and while the leading edge of wages might be rising quite quickly, the vast bulk of us getting wage increases starting with a 2. In time, I hope that 2 turns to a 3, because if we're going to deliver you an average rate of inflation of 2.5%, I think we're going to have to see wage growth starting with a 3 for the country as a whole, as long as we can deliver reasonable productivity growth. So we are expecting wage growth to pick up, and that will underpin a rise in inflation, but only a fairly gentle and modest rise in inflation in underlying terms, not like in the United States. In our central scenario, which we published in November, underlying inflation is expected to increase to 2.5% by the end of 23. So 2.5% is the midpoint of our target band, and that will be the first time in 7 years that we've got to the midpoint. It's quite different to a country where inflation is near 7%. We're in quite a different position than many other countries, and that's important when we think about monetary policy. So this is where I'd like to finish with a couple of points about monetary policy. The first relates to the RBA's bond purchase program, which has provided additional support to the economy during the pandemic. We've purchased a lot of government bonds over the last year and a half. These purchases have helped lower funding costs right across the country. They've supported asset values, and they've led to an exchange rate which is lower than what otherwise would have been, which has helped many exporters. So we've bought a lot of bonds, and the board is going to consider the future of the bond purchase program at our next meeting, which is in early February. Ahead of that decision, we had a preliminary discussion of three options at our meeting last week. All three options are based on the premise that the economy continues to grow strongly and that we don't experience another serious setback. The first option we discussed was to further taper the bond purchases from the current rate of $4 billion a week, with an expectation that the purchases would come to an end in May. The second option we discussed was to further taper the bond purchases and then review the situation again in May. And the third option was to cease the bond purchases altogether in February. In deciding between these options, the board will use the same three criteria that it's used from the outset. They are the actions of other central banks, the functioning of our bond market, and most importantly, the actual and expected progress towards our goals for full employment and inflation consistent with the target. So they're the criteria we're using. We've made no decision yet. Much will depend upon the news we receive between now and when we meet in February. Importantly, we'll receive further readings on inflation and the strength of the labour market, including later today when the labour force survey is published. We'll also learn more about spending in the economy over the summer. We'll learn more about the actions of other central banks, and we'll also learn more about the effects of Omicron. So we'll learn quite a lot between now and when we meet in February. The first option, namely to reduce the rate of purchases from mid-February with an expectation that the end point is in May, is broadly consistent with the forecasts that we released in November for employment and inflation. If better than expected progress is made towards the board's goals, then the case to cease the bond purchases in February will be stronger. Alternatively, if progress is slower than expected, or the outlook becomes more uncertain, the case for retaining flexibility and review again in May would be stronger. The second point that I wanted to make about monetary policy is that the Reserve Bank will not increase the cash rate until... And we're still a fair way from that point. In our central scenario, the condition for an increase in the cash rate will not be met next year. It's likely to take time for that condition to be met, and the Reserve Bank Board is prepared to be patient. We're in no hurry to increase interest rates. Thank you very much for listening, and I'd be happy to answer some questions. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Look, it's an enormous pleasure to be here this morning. My name is Merin Gilsall, and I'm the President and Chair of CBA Australia. And on behalf of our board and all of the organisation, absolute honour and privilege and real thrill to have both Dr and Governor Philip Lowe, the Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, here with us today. So Philip, thank you. You've taken us on a bit of a jaunt around the overall economy, how Australia sits in relation to international factors. You've looked at housing, you've looked at inflation, and the labour market, and lots of other things. Now, I've got a list of questions here, and I know that there'll be others who desperately want to ask you questions, but let me just ask one. I wanted to just acknowledge that CBA Australia has recently released its own survey of business and economic sentiment. And so we're hearing from our members and businesses about such things that you've talked about, the labour shortage, and concerns that will actually hamper economic recovery. And given that you've touched on that, I thought I might just touch on another point, which is, do you see that there are concerns arising from, I might put the word capricious in front of some of the lockdowns and things that impact both business and the ability for organisations to attract labour, even with technology supporting flexibility. Do you see things like uncertainty because of the issues of Omicron and how that will fit with the Delta variant impacting business and therefore making the recovery more difficult, which will impact obviously all of our colleagues here in the room today?
Well, I think the Omicron variant is obviously a source of uncertainty. But I think most businesses are looking to the future, a more optimistic future. I think most businesses are looking to a more optimistic future now. As I said in my remarks, we've got a very extensive business liaison program. And what we hear from businesses at the moment is that they've delayed investment and they want to start investing again. and we're starting to see some of that in the heart data. And what we hear from business, we don't have major lockdowns again. I think they'll have enough confidence to proceed. Their balance sheets are in good shape. People are getting jobs. I'm confident about the future, provided that we don't have another major lockdowns to deal with the virus. That would set us back again. But if we don't have those lockdowns, I think we can go forward and grow with confidence.
Thank you. Now, I've got Michelle Caruso, the New South Wales General Manager, to take any questions from the floor. So I'll take a few questions from the floor and then see if there are any from the media. So questions that anybody else would like to ask?
Thank you, Dr. Phillip, for coming here today. I've got a question for the future. With the federal election pending and some political pundits tipping a hung parliament, Michael would probably disagree with me on that. What effect do you think that'll have with your role, and what effect will that have with the economy going forward?
I think the answer to that is not very little, if anything. I mean, you know, the Reserve Bank does its job independent of politics, so the elections don't really affect us at all. In some situations, the election can lead to uncertainty, which can lead to people kind of delaying spending, but the effect there is pretty minor. When we look back through history, there's not very much evidence that the uncertainties associated with election slows the economy for anything other than a very short period of time. So I'm not expecting the election to have any effect on the economic momentum.
Your tenure at 7 years, how are you hoping to leave the balance sheet in the next 3 years? Have you got your own personal KPI of where you'd like to see that on your last days
coming? No, not really. It'll be bigger than it is today because we've got kind of more bonds to buy. An issue that we will have to confront next year and the year beyond that is what to do with the bonds that are maturing, because we buy these bonds and then they mature. So at our meeting next year, we will consider how we deal with the proceeds of those maturities. We could reinvest them in government bonds, or we could just have our balance sheet shrink. So that's something that we'll turn our mind to next year. I think the other factor that's influencing the size of our balance sheet is the demand for those banknotes. Now, there's $100 billion out there in banknotes, so that's grown 5%, 6%, or 7% a year. Even though we're not using these banknotes for transactions, most of us are using cards or our phones to make payments, but it continues to astound me that the demand for those banknotes keeps growing. And longer term, the issue is whether we move to a payment system which is based on tokens sitting in our digital wallets. And I spoke last week at a speech in Sydney about the various possibilities. Those tokens could be backed by the central bank. They could be backed by a private bank, or in some parallel universe, I think that could be just kind of, you know, a different currency completely. But I don't think that's likely to happen. But it's quite possible we could end up in a world where the Reserve Bank is backing digital tokens in digital wallets, which would mean a bigger balance sheet again. So there are a lot of moving parts there. And the short answer to your question, I don't have a KPI about the size of my balance sheet. My main KPI is to deliver you an average rate of inflation of 2.5%. And I'm falling short on that, and we want to do what we can to get there.
And presumably also remain independent of the whole political system in pursuing that overarching goal.
But I don't have any concerns about that at all. I've been at the Reserve Bank since 1979, when I finished high school. So I've been there a lot of years. And right through those years, I've never seen any political interference in the Reserve Bank. The politicians are very respectful of the Reserve Bank. They do not interfere. Michael could verify that. And we go, do our job. We take our decisions independently in the public interest. So I don't have any concerns about that at all.
Thank you.
And it's a credit to the Australian political system that they let the central bank do its job in the public interest. It's really a credit to the politicians of both sides that they've let that happen.
Got it. Sort of wanting your take on it. As we sort of go into the business plan for our small and medium enterprises in 2022, a lot of the boards that I'm working with are looking at trying to obviously restrict the wage growth and offer like remote working and a lot of more flexibility that we've had to adapt businesses. What's the Reserve Bank take on? Obviously you wanted wage growth to increase, but I guess the pressure that we're seeing is probably going to be coming up with strategies to try and keep that as long as possible. So have you got any, what's your take on how the Reserve Bank's going to tackle some of those challenges from the small business and the medium enterprise?
Well, let me describe my central bank nirvana to you. It's an inflation rate that's averaging 2.5%. Labour productivity growth of 1.5%, so that's generating growth in real wages, which is really important for our living standards, and wages growing at 4%, and full employment. So 2.5% wages growth, strong labour productivity growth, strong growth in real wages, and nominal wages growing at 4% and full employment. That's where I would like to see us get to. Whether we can get there, I don't know, but stronger growth in wages than we have had over the past decade, I think, is in the national interest, underpinned by productivity growth. So I want to see your businesses be incredibly productive and be able to pay wage increases north of 3% and be willing to do that because they're becoming more productive. And whether we get to that nirvana, I don't know, but I think there's a chance. And with the right government policies generating productivity growth and businesses who are prepared to invest and be innovative, I think we can do that.
And I have to put in a plug for this profession. So whether it is public practitioners advising their clients or those working in businesses, owning businesses, CFOs, but also in academia and not-for-profits, they've all got a role in terms of that productivity and efficiency and how, when you think about the digitalisation of businesses and all that this profession can help with, we really do have an important role.
And this is where kind of where training is really
Absolutely.
Important. You know, when I entered the labour market was quite tight. And what firms did was spend a lot of resources attracting and training people. And I think that drives productivity growth and it will help deal with some of the skill shortages and drive productivity growth. So at the moment, I've been talking quite a lot to people about the importance of reinvesting in training, skills development, in technical skills. I think it's a job for both business and for government to support that.
And we've got another question.
Thank you for your lovely presentation today. Back to your digital token idea, I just want to understand the idea behind it. Is it supposed to be an investment asset that's competing with modern cryptocurrency or a replacement to banknotes or a mix of both?
I think it's largely a replacement to banknotes. I mean, I don't know whether we'll end up here, but you could imagine a world in which there are Australian dollar tokens that sit in your digital wallet, and then people bump their phones together, and the tokens move. So, whether the technology can be developed on a commercial scale, and we can deal with all the security and issues. Because you just think kind of broadly back through kind of the history of mankind, the nature of money's changed a lot. People used to use clamshells. And then the colony of New South Wales, they used rum for a while, didn't they? And then we used kind of paper. Now you have these kind of fantastic polymer notes. And I think it's quite possible, again, that then sometime in the next decade, we say, look, why are we passing around pieces of plastic? Can't we pass around electronic tokens? I think they would still be in Australian dollars. And the private market could deliver those kind of a form of stable coin. Another lesson from history is not that just money evolves, but private money often ends in disaster. Now, it's good for a while, but when something happens and confidence is shaken, people really want money that's backed by the central bank and ultimately by the government, don't they? So that's in the back of our mind as well. So it's quite possible we end in a world where these tokens issued by the private banks and backed by the central bank, and we're working through the possibilities of that now. So it's a really exciting area that brings together technology and public policy.
Thanks very much for being here today. Back to, I suppose, the challenge of improving education and training. Is this going to be an issue for governments, considering that in the past international students have been, I suppose, largely funding the, especially the tertiary sector?
I don't know whether it's a challenge for government. I think it's a challenge for business as well, because a lot of training takes place in the workplace, doesn't it? Kind of, it's actually, a lot of us learn by doing, observing our colleagues, and this is at the Reserve Bank why I'm very keen for the staff to come back at least together physically half the time, because I think we're stronger as a team and we learn more by coming together. So no doubt there are issues in the university sector that need addressing, but I think it's a mistake to think that it's up to government really just to do all the training. Businesses have to do the training as well. I think for the last two decades, with the labour market not being that tight and being able to tap the international labour market, there hasn't been the same pressure on businesses to train people as there was when I entered the labour force. And I think if the unemployment rate's going to get back to where we were in the early 70s, businesses are going to have to step up as well. Not to say there's not issues in the education sector, but it's a combined responsibility.
Yeah, wholeheartedly agree. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I think there was... Any question?
Hello. Just a question from one of my colleagues. If the bond buying program does wrap up in May, what does that say about the likely timing of the first interest rate rise?
It says nothing about... We view these two decisions as completely separable. I mean, they're obviously both linked in a way that they're both responding to the state of the economy, but the bond purchase program can stop either in February or May, and has no implications at all for the timing of the next, of an increase in interest rates. The decision about interest rates is really going to be determined by how we're going on this objective of getting inflation sustaining between 2% and 3%. We're not even to two, and you know, we're at 2.1% at the moment. First time in 6 years we've been inside our target range, so we're still not at the point where we can confidently say that inflation is going to be sustained between 2% and 3%. And I think for us to conclude that, wages growth will probably have to be 3%. It's possible we could have inflation of 2.5% and wages growth staying with a 2%, but that would be implying that productivity growth was very weak. So I really hope that doesn't happen, but it is possible. I think it's going to be some time before wage growth has a 3% in front of it at the aggregate level and inflation sustainably at 2.5%. So we can finish the bond purchase program and that has no implications for the timing of interest rate. That's the basic point.
Thank you. And I think one last question.
In terms of the options you set out for monetary policy, if option 3 did kind of play out and we had lockdowns that affected productivity and we had to keep monetary policy fairly loose, how do you see sort of the divergence from the rest of the world if, say, New Zealand, America, Canada, the European Union are moving towards tighter monetary policy at the same time that we're keeping fairly loose with, you know, large bond purchases? Do you see any problems or what sort of complications do you see from that potential outcome?
I don't see any problems, but if everyone else is stopping bond purchases or even tightening monetary policy and we're not, the main effect on the Australian economy would be a lower exchange rate. Because this is one of the reasons why we started purchasing the bonds, because everyone else was doing it, and if we didn't do it, our interest rates, our bond yields would go up and the exchange rate would go up, and given we were looking over the abyss, we didn't think that was sensible. So we were very much influenced by the actions of other central banks. The margin, if they stop doing this, then it increases the probability that we will stop as well. But if we think it's the right thing to do to keep going, we will. And the main effect would be effect on the exchange rate.
Well, look, unfortunately, that is going to draw us to a close, but I'm going to take the opportunity to just reflect on behalf of all our local members here. It's fabulous when a local person, and in this case a boy from the bush, has grown up to have such a stellar career. And I'm sure the folk here, in this glorious day,
would be interested, Philip, to hear if there are any fond memories you have of growing up in the region that you'd be willing to share with us.
Well, I have a lot of fond memories, as I said at the start, of kind of coming to this park, and it had a fantastic kind of a playground over there. So my mother would, you know, I'm one of five, so we'd come here and we'd kind of muck up in this park. You could get lost, wouldn't have to be with the parents because there was a zoo over there as well. So that was kind of fantastic. And as a child, I played a lot of golf out at the Wagga Wagga Country Club. So I have very fond memories of that. And my time at Trinity in St Michael's is fantastic. So I feel kind of incredibly privileged. When I was here, my parents used to say, well, make sure you work hard, be nice to people, and have a positive attitude. I think they're kind of country attributes, aren't they? Hard work, be nice to people, and have a positive attitude. That's kind of, they're kind of universal values, but I feel like they're particularly country values. And I've tried to carry those through with my life. Work hard, be nice to people. As my mother used to say, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. So I tried to do that, and you know, keep a positive attitude. And I think it's, you know, this country is fantastic. We're the luckiest people in the world to live here, and you know, you look at places like this, it's just kind of fantastic. And you know, we've got a fantastic future ahead of us, and we've just got to seize it.
Well, as a girl who grew up in the country, I must say I grew up with very similar values.
Yeah.
So that certainly resonates with me, as I'm sure it does with everybody else in the room. So on behalf of CPA Australia and all our members, and particularly those here today, thank you so much
for
a fascinating presentation and the breadth and depth of the topics you've covered in such a brief period of time is extraordinary, and obviously a testament to your incredible ability, and we thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.